Welcome to the Surviving Grief Podcast, hosted by our grief ministry leaders at Crossroads Church. We'll be sitting down with friends as they share their powerful stories of loss and healing, and we'll hear from grief professionals and other wise people with useful tools for our own time of grief. If you're supporting someone who's grieving, you'll learn how to comfort them and walk with them on their own path to healing. Let's join the conversation.
Welcome to another episode of Surviving Grief. My name is Megs Gelfgat, and I'm going to be taking you through a teaching episode on miscarriages. Grieving a miscarriage can be a unique and complex experience, different from grieving other types of losses. And so in the context of a man and woman or a husband and wife grieving the same loss of a child, you know, they go through wildly different cycles and emotions and how they process a miscarriage. And so because this can be somewhat of an ambiguous loss, right, in contrast to other types of losses where there's a clear physical presence of the person who's died, a miscarriage, it often involves a sense of what now? And so I use that word ambiguous because that's how I felt when I experienced a miscarriage about 3.5 years ago. And so today I'm going to share a little bit about my story and what my grieving process looked like. And then also, what does this look like for you as the woman, as the mom going through a loss? What does this look like for you as the dad, as potentially the husband or the partner of someone who's experiencing a miscarriage? And also for the support people, how can you come alongside them and really help walk that difficult journey of loss with them? So again, my name is Megs, and my story, we got to go back just a little bit. So I've been married for going on 13 years now, goes in a blink. And I can remember I was about 2.5, 3 years into to my marriage to my husband, Mike. And we were in Arizona visiting my family. I have two older sisters, Caroline and Susanna, and my middle sister, Susanna, had just had a baby, little Ava Grace. She was so cute. And this was the first baby that I had really been around recently, right? We didn't have friends who had kids at that point. So we get home from Arizona. I'm like, Mike, baby, let's do it. So it's about January at this point in time. He's like, okay, he's on board. And it's about a week later that I'm like, you know what? We got summer coming up. We got things. We got vacations coming. Let's wait and let's try in the fall. Friends, when I tell you it was too late, I was already pregnant at that point. It was super fertile. And so I go through this pregnancy journey and have our oldest. Her name is Mila. And it was wonderful. It was a wonderful, wonderful experience. Top to bottom, felt good the whole time. Delivery was good. Everything was good. And so life continues. And so more time is passing. I'm like, oh, listen, Mike, you know, as we do with our husbands, like, okay, so if we're going to have more, we got to do it now. And so we had almost the exact same conversation where, you know, it was in February. And I'm like, let's get through the summer. Let's do that. Because, you know, at this point, I think Mila was 6, 7-ish years old. And so at that point, for my new parents, you got so much freedom. I could travel with her, you know, Mike and I could take trips and leave her and then come back. I mean, so there, as a parent, when you don't have a toddler anymore, you just have a lot of freedom. So the plan was we were going to get through the spring, get through the summer, and then we're going to try for another baby. So I go on a surf trip to Nicaragua. This is only a few days after this conversation with my husband. And once again, it was too late. there was just something inside of me that when I was on this surf trip, I kind of just felt like a little nauseous. And I remember I had a pina colada in front of me and I had no reason to suspect that I was pregnant. And I'm just like, you know what? Let me just hold off on this drink. And so for a whole week in Nicaragua with no access to like a pregnancy test, I just had this feeling of like, oh man, am I pregnant again? Like it just happened like so fast, right? And I remember really struggling because even though I wanted more kids, here I am on this trip and business is really busy and there's some exciting opportunities. And I'm like, this is not a great time to get pregnant. And so even though it wasn't confirmed at that point, these were the emotions and the feelings that I was really sorting through of like, not right now. It's not convenient. So sure enough, I get home. And I am pregnant. I'm about 5 weeks pregnant. and it's still super early. And I just remember looking at my husband, we're both laughing. It's like, we can't even say the word pregnant, and we're just showing up pregnant. And so it took another, at least another month and a half before I was like fully on board. And I remember really struggling because I was so excited with Mila, with our first. I'm like, you know, that we're doing this baby thing. It's going to be great. But for me in the second pregnancy, it was this a little bit selfish, right? Like I had things I wanted to do. I knew like with some international travel, I would have a hard time doing that later in the pregnancy. And then I had to postpone things. And so it was a lot of like me, me, me. How am I going to be inconvenienced in this? But I really worked through that. And Mike and I talked about it. Our daughter, Mila, we told her that we were pregnant. She cried, not in a good way. When you're an only child for so long, you know, I remember we were sitting at the dining room table and we were filming it to send to my family. We're like, Mila, you are going to have a sibling. It's going to be a little brother, a little sister. And she smiled at first, and it was like the 10-second delay. And then the crying, I think she cried for a half an hour. She just was not on board with that. So, you know, here we are, the Gelfgat family, we're soldiering on. And so now it's May, and I'm just past my my second trimester. I'm going in for my routine visits. And we really got to the point of like, all of the hard challenges and some of the selfishness that I had about being inconvenienced, which even now I cringe saying that, but inconvenienced with the timing of the pregnancy, you know, I felt like we had moved past that. So I go in for my appointments and everything is really great and continues to be great. And so we move past the second trimester. And so, you know, I think we were right about halfway through the second trimester at this point. And my husband, we'd been through this before, right? I had really healthy pregnancies, no issues. And so when I would go in for sonogram visits, he wouldn't come. He's like, yep, take a video, you know, show me the pictures. That's great. But it wasn't something that we made a point to do together. So it's the middle of the afternoon. I'm kind of had a full day of meetings. So I'm just popping into this sonogram appointment. You're in the dark room. Just putting the jelly on. I remember I was still on my phone. I was, you know, responding to an email or something like that. And all the lights are off and you have this TV in front of you. So I'm looking up and, you know, and I see things, but I don't really know what I'm looking at. And I'm listening for the heartbeat. And I just thought she was still turning stuff on. And there was no awkward pause. There was no preface. There was nothing like that. This woman, in hindsight, I felt like it was a pretty callous statement at the time. She's like, oh, honey, there's no heartbeat. Sorry about that. And then the floor dropped out. And I remember that I heard her say that, but again, kind of in the context of this dark room, and I thought she was booting up the machine. And I asked her to repeat herself. I'm like, what? I'm sorry, what did you just say? And again, pretty kind of nonchalantly, there's not a heartbeat. What does that mean? Show me, what am I looking at? I don't know what that means. And I remember getting really agitated of like, stop giving me these complex explanations, which really they weren't complex. There's not a heartbeat. It doesn't get more straightforward than that. But in my mind, I'm like, what am I missing here? Like, catch me up. Like, suddenly I was very present in the room, right? The emails are forgotten. Tell me what is going on. I just remember repeating that over and over. So she stands up, she takes her gloves off, and she's like, I'll give you a couple minutes and then you can meet with the doctor and figure out what to do. So she leaves the room. I just remember sobbing because I didn't understand what was happening, sobbing because I was past that 12 weeks, that kind of into the second trimester of like, this isn't an issue. And I have good pregnancies and easy pregnancies. Like, what is happening right now? And so she comes back a few minutes later. I don't even know how I got my pants back on, right? Like as you're getting this ultrasound, right? Like I'm getting dressed and there's still like the gel on my stomach and I'm just like so out of sorts. And I'm like carrying like a purse and like a coffee. Like I'm just juggling all of these things. Like in hindsight, I kind of looking at this comedy of errors. And you know, in these doctor's offices, I'm sure this is something that they see all the time. And I can look back and really have grace on that woman because, you know, for them, this is relatively routine. And I'm sure this is a conversation, you know, hopefully she's not having daily, but I'm sure based on her reaction, it's happening with a certain level of frequency. So she comes back into the room, she turns the lights on. So I'm carrying all these things. And so she's like, I'll put you in the doctor's other office. So I'm just crying loudly. And you know, these poor women that are there for excited for their sonograms and their doctor's appointments, I have to walk through open doors and they just hear me just bawling, and you know, the panic as everyone is like looking around, and I'm making eye contact with these women, and you could just see people tensing up of like kind of thankful that it wasn't them and not sure what was happening. And you know, I can remember that some of the women had their husbands with them, and the husbands would look down, and so you're kind of taking in all of this information in rapid time, but you're not necessarily processing through it in real time. And so I sit in this little office that's the size of a closet. And I remember just resenting the size of this office. Like, is this even a real doctor? You know, I was part of an OB group where there was like seven or eight doctors. And so I'm sitting in front of like a grandfather figure that I had never seen before, I had never met before. Apparently, he was my doctor for the day. He's got to be in his early 70s. And so he's just sitting across from me quietly. And he's like, so I heard we have some bad news. I'm still crying. And again, I reverted to just this mad. I was mad how they told me. I was mad that I wasn't getting reasons for why this happened. Like, I wanted facts. I didn't want people to coddle me at this point. Like, help me understand, like, how can we fix this when really there was nothing to be fixed? And so he was just telling me, we're not sure what happened. We just know that there's not a heartbeat. And because you're this far along, I think that we should admit you to the hospital and we should do this. And he's kind of just really calmly going through all of these explanations. And my head is just spinning, and I'm just texting my husband and, you know, partially listening to what this man is telling me. Bless his heart. You know, I was awful to him in that moment. And so I was parked somewhere in a parking garage. I must have spent 45 minutes trying to find my car, crying, still have the coffee, still have the purse, like just sweating, just, you know, up and down in May in Cincinnati, trying to find my car. And I remember swearing, and I remember just being mad. And I'm like, this is what I'm dealing with right now. Like, I'm in the middle of a miscarriage and I can't find my flipping car. I mean, it was the longest 45 minutes ever. I get to the car, get my husband on the phone, and he is in, how do I fix this? How do I help? What do you need from me? And true to form, I don't know. In previous episodes, I talked about that same sister, Susanna, who had that beautiful little girl, Ava. She passed away from complications of a car accident. And she died, I want to say it was maybe 4-ish years prior to this. And so I had already experienced grief that was close to me, and I had experienced it somewhat delayed. You know, my grief journey didn't start until about a year after I lost my sister. But man, was it a journey, and it was very transformative for me. And then ultimately it had led me to be a grief group leader here at Crossroads. So at this point, I'm like a few years in to working with people with grief. Like, I am very familiar with it. I've worked with people who had miscarriages and stillborns. I knew the tools. I knew what early grief looked like. I was very familiar with grief. And yet, with this ambiguous loss of a second trimester miscarriage, I felt completely lost. I just felt rage. So as I'm back in the car, and my husband's like, well, tell me what to do. What do you need me to do? I just reverted to the anger that had been familiar to me after the loss of my sister. In that case, Susanna had struggled with addiction for many years, found sobriety, and then had passed away after 4 years of sobriety in this car accident. So I can remember I had this anger that just bubbled up in all of my interactions. And so immediately that same anger showed up in dealing with my husband in that moment. I didn't take into account anything about how he's feeling about this. And, you know, poor Mike, he would even say that his concern at that moment was me. Well, how can I help you physically? What do you need from me emotionally? What do you need from me? And so his grief really got put on the back burner, and just let's get through the next little bit. So we go home. I was scheduled to go into the hospital the following day. I'm just sobbing when I get home. Like, it was just a soul crushing moment. And I was crying for our family. I was crying out of guilt that it had taken me so long to kind of get on board with this blessing. Did I cause this with my poor attitude? Just all of the kind of rampant emotions that were flying around. And so I'm laying on the couch, and our daughter comes home from school with Mike. I remember her just coming over. And so Mike had shared that we had lost the baby, you know, as best we could, kind of with the kid glove explanation of what was happening and that mama wasn't feeling good. So I remember Mila just crying as well. You know, so the whole family, we're just in it right now. We're just crying. And sweet little Mila said, but I didn't know if it was a brother or a sister yet. And friends, when I tell you, that just took me over the waterfall of, you know, you're having a hard enough time processing your own emotions and your own kind of like physical manifestations of this miscarriage. And then hearing some of these things of my daughter who had been really resistant to a new sibling, like it was brutal. So we ended up not making it to the appointment the next day for a DNC because I just had a lot of blood and there was a risk of hemorrhage and things like that because I was further along. And so they had me come into the hospital. So because of the late hour that this was all happening, Mike had to stay home with our daughter while we waited for a friend to come over. So in the meantime, I drove myself to the hospital. So I am bleeding through the seats. I mean, in hindsight, I probably should have called an ambulance, but I'm doing this, right? We're in it. Let's just do it all the way. So I'm bleeding all over the car. I'm in pain. I'm crying. And so I remember pulling up to the hospital and as I'm walking myself into the ER and they're like, okay, tell us why you're here. Meanwhile, there's just blood all around me. Like it was just horrible. So they sit me in a chair. And so someone says, we'll take her up to labor and delivery. It doesn't matter that she doesn't actually have a baby. It's just at that point, like you're so numb to what's happening here. And so there wasn't even like the anger that had showed up earlier that day. And so they're looking for a room for me because they're not sure if I'm supposed to be in the ER or labor and delivery. So here I am sitting in a wheelchair by myself in a hallway while an attendant goes to ask some questions about where I'm supposed to be. So I have this kind of core memory of looking down at this white tile floor and just seeing blood that was continuing to flow from me and just like, is this the plan? This can't be the plan. Like, not like this. Like, there's just so much, I felt like trauma in that moment about how I initially heard the news to, you know, in real time, like what I am experiencing. And so they bring me to a room and this sweet nurse who, you know, I don't remember her name, but I remember her face vividly and her curly hair. And so as I'm laying on this now bed, kind of with these mattresses under you to help with the blood as they're making a plan for what's happening, she's talking to another kind of assisting nurse. And she said that, well, we're going to have to take her back for a DNC. And so this younger assistant nurse is like, oh, okay, so we're going to do an abortion. And so this nurse with the curly hair sees me tense up and asks the other gal to step out. And I just remember unloading on her. What are you talking about, an abortion? I just lost my baby. And like, this is how you're treating me. And again, this anger and this rage that felt really familiar, that came to the surface real quick. And to her credit, she just took my hand and she said, I want you to know that I'm going to be with you through this full night. And I know things are really hard and they hurt right now, but I promise this will not be the last pregnancy that you have. And in the moment, it was enough to kind of quell the storm that I felt like was swirling around me. And so she's explaining to me that the process was very similar. And I just felt horrified that it was the same as an abortion. And I felt just like all of these conflicting feelings, even just like within my faith, right? Of like, what does this mean for me? Like, what? I mean, there was so much that came to the surface. My husband wasn't there yet. And so I just felt so isolated and alone in those really difficult moments. But what I had learned earlier in grief with the loss of my sister and just my time working in grief is that in those really hard moments, that's when God shows up in unexpected ways. And that nurse proceeded to share with me that she had four boys, but she had lost three babies as well. And all of her miscarriages had been late term or stillborn. And she just talked about in the moment, like, I know how painful this is for you. I know how hard. And she just really walked me through so many of those emotions in a way that someone else couldn't, who had never experienced a miscarriage. And so because she had that depth of experience and was brave enough to share it with me, someone who was not being very kind to her in the moment, someone who was just in a world of pain, I'm forever grateful for that because it really brought a pause and a calmness of God is in this, and there's people who understand. So as soon as she finishes sharing this portion of the stories, when my husband walked in, bless his heart, he was just sweating bullets. He ran from clear the other side of the hospital, didn't know where to park. He went on his own parking lot journey of, okay, I'm parked. How do I get in now? So that poor hospital, the Galfcats were just not having a great day in terms of parking garages and figuring out where to go. So he comes running in and he's just like, okay, fill me in. Tell me where we're going. What needs to happen? And so, you know, the sweet nurse is kind of giving him the rundown of where do we go from here? And so the rest of the day was pretty simple, right? I go in for this procedure. I come out and they're like, okay, you're going to be good to go in an hour. And it just seemed really like clinical. And outside of that nurse who was so compassionate and so empathetic, it was this really sterile experience of like, you know, I mean, even just sitting in a hallway in a wheelchair. I mean, those are the things when I think back, like, gosh, those are like gut-wrenching. And I know that I'm not the only one who has those core memories where miscarriages are concerned in terms of what people say or, you know, the places that you're put or how you're dealt with. I mean, those are just those initial moments, I think, really shape a lot of what our grief journey looks like, how we assess it, how we feel about it. And so when Mike and I went home without a baby, those next few days, there was just this numbness that came over me. And again, even though I knew the tools, right? I knew logistically what early grief would look like and the fatigue, the physical fatigue and the cognitive brain fog and just so many things. I knew those. And yet I felt really disheartened because this was different than the loss of my sister, right? This was a hope. This was an expectation. And so those next few days, there was really just this numb stillness that came over me. I remember I didn't want my daughter to see me crying. So I went into the bathroom and I closed the door and I turned the fan on. And I just remember sitting on the floor and just crying. And so earlier I talked about that men and women really experience these miscarriage differently, not only because men and women process grief differently, but also the perspectives that they're coming into a miscarriage with. So God love him. My husband knocked on that door and in full questioning, he's like, are you crying in there? And while it's, I know the women listening to this are like, oh, no. So while he really was trying to be empathetic for him, he was like more in a questioning phase of like, am I missing something right now? Like, what's happening in there? Like, is she having a medical emergency? Like, he just didn't know what was happening. And so we had, that would not be the last of comments like that that happened in the grief journey for Mike and I. But as the days evolved, Mike and I are both entrepreneurs and tend to have very busy schedules. And yet coming out of this mourning period, there was a really sacred time that happened for Mike and I where he completely cleared his schedule. I completely cleared my schedule. And every morning after Mila would go to school, we would drive around for about 90 minutes. And that doesn't sound like that would be this really poignant time in a marriage, but we would get our fancy coffee and we would sit in the car. And we would drive around and we would talk about houses. We would talk about what we didn't like, what we would do like. You know, we're looking at $10 million houses and, ugh, that's the landscaping. You know, things like that that felt really benign. And yet it was quality time together. And then every now and then we would kind of talk about where we're at, how we're doing. And it was just this organic experience of being together and experiencing it together. And then the more we did that time together, we talked about what does this look like going forward? And I'm really angry or I'm really hurt. So fast forward to about 6 weeks later, I had no intention of getting pregnant right away. I felt like I was really struggling. I had other friends who were pregnant. I was getting invitations to baby showers and first birthdays. And I had, you know, and even just walking in the grocery store, I would see all these super cute women that are 9 months pregnant. And I just, that anger really surfaced again for me. And so I had no intention of exploring getting pregnant again. I needed to deal with where I was at and that anger. But that fertile uterus really showed up again. And we got pregnant. And I just remember being like, what? Again, really? How do I get excited about a new baby when I'm not done processing the loss of the first? And so I was concerned about just moving on. I didn't have the joy that I had with Mila around, oh, good, it's fine. Like, you know, I think sometimes people in their bid to be supportive, you know, when they say you can have other kids and it's going to be great. I know I wasn't in a place to hear that, with the exception of, you know, in that moment with the woman in the hospital. But I didn't have a space to really hear that and embrace it, because I was mad. Like, I don't want a different baby. I want this baby. I want the baby that I lost. You know, I really kind of, for women, I had that sigh of relief of, I'm in the second trimester. I'm past the danger zone. My history is I had easy pregnancies. And so when I became pregnant, one, I really was grateful that that wasn't the end of the story, because there was fear of like, oh my gosh, is this what it's going to be like going forward? Maybe it was a fluke with Mila. And so I had a lot of anxiety, where that was never anything that had showed up in my life, of just being anxious and being worried constantly. I was taking all these different tests, and I was taking different vitamins, and I was not doing, you know, things that would cause any kind of disruption, you know. So there was just a spirit of worry that was not of God. And I also didn't feel like it was grieving well in the process. And so I had to deal with the strain of relationships. You know, after the loss of my sister, a lot of the strain on my friendships and even my marriage was because I couldn't articulate what I was experiencing. Like, I didn't even realize that's what grief looked like for me until a year later, when I joined a Crossroads grief group and I saw this kind of master list of all the ways grief shows up and what grief truly is. A lot of times I think we just have a vague idea of what it is until we're in it, right? And so at that point, you're playing catch up and you're interpreting everything through the lens of like someone who's hurting. And so now I had the tools, and I knew that I had to be more vocal with my friendships. And so what made this grief journey so different than the loss of my sister is, one, obviously the type of loss was different. But then I really did the work, and I did the work sooner in this loss than I did with my sister. I remember calling girlfriends and saying, hey, I don't know how I'm feeling about this right now. Can we just go out? I want to talk about it. I don't want to talk about it. And that was the change for me, of just being able to verbalize, like, I feel like I need people right now. Can you pray for me? And that was just not something that was present in my first loss. And so Mike and I, you know, after the loss of my sister, he had never experienced deep loss or close loss. And so he was pretty naive to the grief process as well. So I kind of remember handing him a grief book from the Crossroads grief grief group and saying, hey, I need you to read this. This is where I'm at. And I had things like highlighted, like, this, I can't really explain how I'm feeling, but this does. I just need you to read this for me. Let's get on the same page. And so he also had different tools as we went through this, you know, of like identifying, like, where am I at right now? And that can be such a powerful tool of like just giving name to where you're at and allowing God to redeem the pain, redeem the process. You know, I had so much anger initially with how things unfolded in the doctor's office, from the sonogram to the doctor. And it felt like a really easy target to just root bitterness in, because I felt like it was a legitimate gripe. But the fact of the matter is, it wouldn't change anything. It wasn't a malpractice. It wasn't something that they did. It was how they delivered news. And me holding on to that, the only person that was hurting was me. And so being able to release some of that and really forgive and have grace, gosh, I mean, that was so powerful for me in taking the next step forward in my grief journey. About 4 months after the loss, at this point, I'm very pregnant. I felt compelled to do some sort of memorial, and I almost felt like a little embarrassed doing that, because it's not like I had a baby that I could have a funeral for, but I wanted to do something to commemorate that experience. And so my husband and I, we decided to do just something really simple. We did a balloon each where we just wrote a message about, you know, what we had hoped for that child and, you know, the things that we were praying for. So we did this really simple balloon release, and then I wrote journal entries, sometimes to the baby, sometimes to God, sometimes for me. And it was just so cathartic in processing through my grief, in addition to talking to my husband and talking to friends as I navigated this. But even things like Mother's Day was really challenging because, you know, I was a mother of one, but can I say I'm a mother of two? And so there were all of these kind of hard little things that had happened that complicated the healing process. And so I mentioned I was pregnant a third time, and I was woken up in the middle of the night, heavy bleeding. We're in the second trimester, and my husband wakes up in a panic, and we don't even say anything. We just look at each other, and there was this sinking dread of not again. This can't happen again. I can't go through this again. And so once again, I remember just throwing clothes on and driving myself to the hospital, bleeding in the front seat. I promise our cars don't still have blood on all the amount of blood that has moved through our cars, you know. And so my husband came late, and that's when I was diagnosed with placenta previa. And, you know, that the hope was that things were going to be fine, but they weren't sure how severe things were. And so for the next, gosh, at least 3.5 months, I was in and out of the hospital with extended stays because this was around COVID. Mila couldn't come visit me. And so now Mike is very much in Mr. Mom mode, putting our daughter on the bus. She can't see her mom. We would FaceTime. Mike would come to the hospital and visit me. And he would be there for 30 minutes in the morning with a coffee. And then he would have to go. And so I would be in what felt like pregnancy prison in this little room all day, couldn't leave the room. And I would see one nurse and one doctor twice a day. That was it. You know, outside of, you know, them dropping off food, but I was by myself. So talk about really getting close with God. I felt physically alone, but then also it gave me an opportunity to like really sort through my feelings. And so placenta previa kind of gave us issues through that entire pregnancy. And while we delivered early and after an extended time in the NICU, our little Hartley Michael was born and is healthy. And he is 2.5 today. He's real cute, friends. He's real cute. And that's my story of miscarriage. And so now being on the other side of it, what I thought I knew about miscarriage is very different than what I lived with it. And so that's why I felt like it was really important to walk through some of like the key issues that happen around making miscarriage a unique type of grieving. You know, first, just through the lens of if this is your first pregnancy, right, and you go through Mother's Day, are you still a mother? You know, there's all of these kind of different triggers that can vary if you have other children, right? And so I think sometimes those initial miscarriages, if this was your only child, they can be harder hitting. So when we have the loss of future dreams, miscarriage, it represents not only the loss of a pregnancy, but the future hopes, the dreams associated with that child. And so parents may have already begun planning for the future, right? You have the nursery, you have the registry, maybe you already had the baby shower, right? These were all kind of the hopes that you had that you were excited about. There's so much excitement with it, especially if it's your first. I think that there is a social stigma and a silence that comes with miscarriage. It's often surrounded by this, do we talk about it? Do we not? Oh, was it really a baby? I mean, you were so early. You hear people talk about that, like, you were so early. Oh, I'm just so glad you weren't in the third trimester. You know, just people can say some things that are not always really tactful and can be very hurtful. And I get it, friends. I get when those wounds cut extra deep. But I think the goal of really dissecting what miscarriage grief looks like is to take our deepest wounds and transform them into wisdom. And that's what resilience looks like, especially when we grieve and hope with Jesus. For mothers, you're also experiencing a physical grief, right? The physical experience of a miscarriage, whether you had to have a procedure, whether you actually delivered, but the physical toll impacts the emotional pain. So women are going to experience the symptoms even after the fact. Sometimes it's the nursing, maybe, you know, you're still having to pump, things like that, the cramping. I mean, there's this physical piece of you go home, you don't have a baby, and we have all these repercussions that you're dealing with. And then I think there's also a role of blame and guilt. Parents may grapple with feelings of, gosh, could I have done something differently? What could I have done? And so those feelings can be particularly intense for mothers, whether they, you know, they blame themselves about, well, I wasn't excited enough, or I didn't do this enough, or I should have eaten that, or I should have, you know, there's those why questions of what could I have done. Not only do they not bring you to anywhere productive, they can force you to spin in that same cycle of just grief over and over, where every day is as hard as day one. With miscarriages, I also think that there's this disenfranchised grief that isn't talked about very often, where miscarriages, it's often considered a form of grief that's like lesser than, right? If you lost a two-year-old, I think people treat you a little differently than a miscarriage at, you know, 12 weeks. I think that those are different types of losses. And so that meaning that not only we attached to it, but other people, you know, when you're recognized by society as a legitimate form of loss versus like, oh, should I really be sad about this? And so we have to like legitimize our grief, which I think can really complicate how we move through the grief process, because there's this guilt of like, well, I mean, other people have lost, you know, two-year-olds. Should I really be as sad as them? I think also there is a lack of closure. So miscarriage, right? It's not this, there's not a ceremony usually, right? There's not a funeral or memorial service. So without a formal ritual to mark the loss, parents, they're going to struggle with a sense of closure and acceptance. There's the timing of the loss, you know, was it early? How early? Was it a chemical pregnancy? I mean, I think all of those contribute to this disenfranchised grief. It can be a little bit of a taboo topic as well. Just culturally, especially when abortion does run rampant, it's just like, oh, was it a baby yet? And so, you know, you might have your own feelings about that, but for me, I feel like from conception, that is a baby and that is a life and it has value. And then lastly, for women, what is the impact on our relationships, right? With your significant other, with your friends or partners, your family members, right? They have their own hopes and expectations on this pregnancy. So those differences in grieving style, the feelings of blame or resentment, a lack of communication, that strain in relationships during the difficult time, I mean, those all really make it hard, I think, to grieve openly with a miscarriage. And so for my men, I didn't forget about you, right? Because your job is also complicated. Your grief often gets put on the back burner immediately. And so you are in a place of, how can I help? How can I fix this, right? Men typically are the fixers, where women are, what are the feelings, right? Let me tell you about where I'm at. Here's all the things that I'm feeling, the ups and the downs, where men come in and they want to fix it. And so most often what the men report is that their job, their focus is, okay, how can I just attend to my wife or my partner? How can I just be in it with her? And so some practical things that I want to offer to you is, number one is like, listen, she may or may not have something to say, but even just your physical presence, gosh, it validates her experience by you acknowledging her pain, because that gives a reassurance that other people can't give, right? You as the father have a different perspective than, you know, her mother or her friend. Second is asking, how can you help? Instead of assuming what your wife or partner needs, asking directly, how can you support her better? And a great way to do that is open-ended questions like, what can I do to help you feel better? Is there anything specific that you need from me right now? And I'm sure you gentlemen already know this, but if you think that she's crying in the bathroom, don't knock on the door and say, are you crying in there? Luckily, Mike and I can smile about that now. I will say that. A couple other suggestions for you if you were kind of in those early stages of miscarriage as the husband, as the partner, just being present, right? Offer that physical affection, hold her hand, just sit in silence with her. You know, it takes a really strong man to be able to share his feelings. And you may not know what those feelings are like, and share that too, just expressing your emotions. Taking care of practical matters, I can't express how helpful that was, that Mike really stepped into so effectively and efficiently. And so whether it's you doing it yourself or employing the friends and families that just want to shower you in support, take the household chores and the errands and the responsibilities or helping out with your other children, take that off her plate to help lighten her load so that she can recover physically and that she can really start to have that space to grieve, right? Take care of meals, either have somebody else cook them. I mean, you have people in your community and your network who want to help support you, but you got to ask. And so you really being assertive in that role, I think is very, very important. And of course, just your patience and understanding together. And so now the other side of this coin for men, in addition to actually supporting the woman, is what does this look like for you to grieve? Because we talked about men and women, they process grief very differently. And so in the time that we've worked with men around stillborns and specifically miscarriages, you know, some of the emotions that they report having is, number one, just feeling powerless, right? You may or may not already be educated on what caused the miscarriage, but so many men express feelings of just powerlessness as they're unable to prevent this tragedy, right? Like they can't protect their partner. They couldn't protect their baby from this experience. And so as a result, they have guilt and they also have that self-blame, wondering, was there something that could have been done differently to prevent this? When we've done these shared grief sessions, the men specifically talk about feeling like they're putting the walls up. So there's this emotional withdrawing that happens because you're just trying to cope. Right? You're trying to cope with your feelings, but compartmentalize to be as effective as you can for your partner and supporting her. And so that difficulty expressing emotions, that can actually lead to more frustration, right? Because those emotions have to go somewhere. And so the more they get bottled up, it's really going to stifle how you move forward. Sometimes I think men don't get the same support from their community. Right? There's so much attention that's placed on the woman. Physically, she's going through it, and then emotionally as a mother. But the sense of loss and sadness equally applies to you as the father, mourning the loss of a baby and the future that they envisioned. And so we really encourage you to journal. And if you are new to the journaling space, it's a pen and a piece of paper and you just let it flow and give yourself some boundaries, right? 5 minutes. I'm going to write about where I feel like I'm at. And you might start in one place and end in another, but it's creating the space to actually share. Last things around kind of the symptoms that so many men report, they have their own physical symptoms, right? Women we know have the pregnancy loss, but the physical symptoms for a man are very, very intense as well. So headaches, fatigue, changes in appetite or sleep patterns. You know, in some of our earlier episodes, we covered early grief and all the physical manifestations of grief. And so for men grieving a miscarriage, they're going to come and they're going to come with a force. And so your coping mechanisms might be throwing yourself into work, throwing yourself into taking care of your spouse or spending time with friends or family or other children that you have. But really making a long-term plan for how is my grief impacting me day to day? Is it impacting my relationship? And how can I be more open to engaging with my spouse or my partner? And so friends, I just want to encourage you that wherever you're at currently in your grieving process of a miscarriage, whether it is new, whether it is years ago, that your loss is valid. It's not, oh, you should just get over this. That however you're feeling about it, that's okay. There's no right or wrong way for you to process through your grief. And that I would just really encourage you to lean into God in this process and ask for what you need. One of our other leaders, Kelly, she has this really great quote that guilt is shame, and it does not heal. Regret is sorrow, and sorrow heals. And what to me, as I look back on my own miscarriage, I had so much guilt around those early days of just not being excited. And so when I think about good grief now from that miscarriage and the tools that I have, you know, I regret some of those early thoughts and those early attitudes, and I have sorrow for the loss. But friends, God has redeemed this in my life. He's redeemed it through another baby. He has redeemed it relationally with my husband. Our family was closer as a result of this really difficult time together. And I would just really encourage you that this is not the end of your story, whether it's future children or not, that this isn't the end of the story for you, and this isn't the end of the plan that God has for your life if you just trust Him and lean into Him in this process. Thanks for being with us today.
Surviving Grief is a production of Crossroads Church, Cincinnati, Ohio. If you'd like to connect or share your own story, reach out to us at podcasts@crossroads.net. That's podcasts with an S at crossroads.net. We'll see you next time.